Well, it's only March, and here on the program we've already discussed the various elections that have taken place across the globe this year. Elections, of course, are the hallmark of democracies, but do they necessarily reflect the health of democratic countries? I mean, if we look at Italy, for instance, where over the last 60 years, there have been more changes of government than years, and this recent election certainly hasn't promised any stability. Quite the reverse. Unfortunately, there's a long list of democratic countries that are faltering, or as my next guest says, democracy is retreating altogether, and he suggests that it's a worldwide trend. To find out why it's been happening in the last 5 years or so especially, and why it's more than the effects of the global financial crisis, I'm joined now by Joshua Kalancic, a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, which is an independent non-partisan membership organisation based in the US. His book is called Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. Welcome to the program, Joshua.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Now, you're refuting, Joshua, the rather accepted view that as nations develop economically and create a middle class, a bourgeoisie, that they'll also become more democratic. Where are you seeing this not happening to support your theory?
Well, first of all, I want to stress that we're looking back at the last 5 or 10 years. You can always make an argument that certainly compared to, say, 1938 or even 1988, there's more democracy in the world now than there was then. But if you look at global studies, both our research and others like Freedom House and The Economist, it shows that support for democracy and democracy itself has declined significantly the last 10 years. So some of the places we're seeing this, where the middle class has really played a role in dissatisfaction and even revolt against democracy, Thailand, Pakistan, Nigeria, Kenya. Kenya is about to have a new presidential election, which is looking like it's shaping up to be potentially another disaster. South Africa, many of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe that were considered success stories after the fall of the Berlin Wall. Those are just a few examples. Italy is a little more complicated, but certainly Italy fits some components of that. Certainly the significant dissatisfaction with the leadership and the dissatisfaction with politics.
We've just actually talked about Kenya on our program, and there's modest, cautious optimism that it won't be a repeat of last time. And, of course, they've introduced all sorts of interesting constitutional changes, insisting that you can't be elected by just being elected by your tribe or your region. So they've forced, after the last debacle, you've got to get representation from a wide range of regions, which I thought was a very intelligent response.
Yeah, they had a constitutional change, and a group of civil society groups are trying to prepare the way, but there are a lot of ominous signs also. There already has been significant violence.
True.
Some of the civil society groups reported that people are stockpiling arms. Kenyatta is facing charges at the same time as the election is going on. My broader point is, when Daniel Arap Moi was no longer in power, it seemed as if Kenya was, which is a very vibrant country, vibrant economy, very strong media, it seemed like it was going to be a success story. And even if this election is, let's say, moderately better than the last one, it certainly is not what people were hoping for after Arap Moi.
No, and look, further, a very interesting one in our region is Malaysia, where Malaysia. That's a very interesting, quotes, democracy. And, of course, they've got an election coming very soon. And somebody remarked the other day that with some notable exceptions like South Korea, the Southeast Asia is not handling democracy as the West understands it very easily at all.
Yeah, I mean, people would have probably said Indonesia is doing a decent job, but SBY's second term has been pretty disastrous for the institutionalization of democratic norms. Malaysia is a perfect example of sort of what I look at. Malaysia has a significant growth rate, has an educated populace, has a large middle class. It certainly fits the standard definition of countries that are ready for democracy, and yet you have a large percentage of the middle class, not everyone, but a large percentage, that are sticking with, and I think probably in this election will stick with, the BN, with the ruling party, which isn't really a democratic party.
So why do you say, because this is the essence of your argument as I understand it, it's that the disappointment the middle class is feeling about democracy, and I'd like you to develop that, please, because if you're right, that is a very important development.
let's say, the middle class and the elite. And Malaysia is a good example, and Thailand is a good example, too. What you have in a lot of these countries is, either in the case of Thailand, you did have real democratic transfer of power, and the government that took over in the early 2000s under Thaksin, essentially the same government now under his sister, they believed in democracy as voting, but they didn't adhere to any of the constitutional forms of democracy. In other words, Thaksin basically disregarded the rule of law. He fostered his own business interests. He was terrible to the media. They had a quote-unquote war on drugs where they were just shooting people with no rule of law. They prosecuted the insurgency in southern Thailand with basically no justice. And eventually the middle class and elites in Thailand grew frustrated that democracy was seeming to mean only one thing, which was voting, and nothing of the constitutional checks and balance. And they turned against it. And so in Thailand you had a coup, and then since then you've had a whole series of other attempts by middle class and elite people to use things other than the voting booth to remove or paralyze government.
Okay, and I know that you also say, for instance, that just getting to the other great drama of our immediate time, the Tahrir Square and Egypt, and you're saying that many of the educated business people, for instance, who sparked the original square uprisings are fleeing the country now.
Yes, I mean, you can see that applications for passports to a whole series of Western countries are up enormously. In order to get a passport, almost by definition in Egypt, you have to be middle class or rich. We just saw that the main opposition party, which is basically represents secular liberals, has decided not even to contest the next elections. And polling shows you have already a huge dissatisfaction among middle class and elite people. The problem with this is you can still have elections, you know, with, and probably win in a country like Egypt or Thailand, maybe even Malaysia, but without having a lot of middle class or elite support. But you can't really run a country that way because you're not going to have the support of institutions of power, of capital, of business, and you need that as well as the voters in order to run the country, which is something that successful transition leaders like Nelson Mandela, for example, understood.
Can I suggest to you that quite a lot of the, seems to me, what occurs is the gap between the middle classes and the countrysides in a lot of these countries that you're describing. And in Egypt, I was astonished during all of that excitement and reporting of Tahrir Square that there wasn't nearly enough questions being overtly asked about whether that the countryside was coming into these demonstrations or not. Turns out they weren't. In other words, isn't a part and parcel of democracy the need to, if you are the bourgeoisie, to find ways to reach into the countryside?
There's two sides, right? I mean, you could say that in Egypt, or you could say that in Thailand or Indonesia or a lot of other places, Venezuela. These are places that are closer or almost democracies on the spectrum. Russia was close, or it was under Yeltsin, flawed, but was. But anyway, you've had opposition movements come up against the sort of populist autocrat, is what I call it in the book, an elected autocrat, right? Vladimir Putin is elected, but he's an elected autocrat, basically. And that's sort of what Thaksin was like, and even what Berlusconi was like somewhat. But the opposition movements in a lot of those places to those elected autocrats, they've never really been able to galvanize people outside of a very certain urban stratum. And so in Russia, for example, you've had a number of protests against Putin, but they always were able to be put down by Putin and characterized as just the Moscow elite. And because they didn't reach out into the countryside, they were successfully basically quashed. And Putin has done that over and over again.
I wonder if part of this disillusionment with democracy that you're charting stems from what everybody's been witnessing in the US, where it's such a struggle for the elected government to get bills passed through Congress, where the money politics is a shocking distortion that I think is possibly viewed in a more grotesque way externally than internally. I mean, newly formed democracies must be looking on quite puzzled.
I mean, I think there's some truth to that. If you look at the global news coverage, certainly the U.S. political system is quite dysfunctional at this point. And I think that if we were in the Cold War, that would certainly be more true when it was the United States in a way pitted against an ideological enemy with a different political system. I don't think that's so true today because people know that there are a lot of different types of democracies and the U.S. style is not necessarily the most effective, and most other democracies don't have as much of the money politics, and certainly parliamentary system doesn't have the same campaign, because campaign for election is not called so far in advance. However, I think at the same time, you do have plenty of other places that have other systems than the U.S. that have been effective. The Scandinavians, Germany, there isn't only one type of democracy.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I couldn't agree with you more. I've always thought that the U.S. at the moment is just not a model to look at. You know, it's quite the reverse. But just coming towards the end, in terms of where you see this heading, I suppose the real risk you suggest is that people who are incipient Democrats are just, in some of these places, like you quote a Thai academic in your book very poignantly when he says, so the Thai government just gets away with it, and they know they're getting away with it, and we are putting off a final explosion in Thai society just a little bit longer. But then he just says, we're just giving up. So, I mean, that's the real risk, isn't it, that you, the very people who could be activists for something different, just give up.
Yeah, I think that's a serious risk. And just to go back to a little bit where we started from, I think that's exactly what's happened in Italy and to some extent in Greece and in some of the Central and Eastern European countries. You have basically just throw your hands up with democratic politics or with politics altogether. And although that might seem satisfying once if you vote for a comedian or, you know, Greece, you see the rise of the far right, you vote for parties that really are not going to be capable of governing, ultimately that's a disaster. And Italy has had 15 years of that already. But I think the long-term problem is that a dissatisfaction with this form of governance with no other real effective form is just going to lead to a withdrawal from politics, and that leads to weaker and weaker societies.
And vacuums, and awful things fill vacuums. Joshua Kolancic, thank you very much for getting us, provoking us to think. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thanks so much.
And Joshua's book is Democracy in Retreat, The Revolt of the Middle Class and the Worldwide Decline of Representative Government. Again, quite thought-provoking, and I hope that you'd let us know whether you agree or disagree or where you think it could be taken up and argued with.